transparent elections. Senators Loeffler and Perdue made the stunning request after both of their races went to runoffs against Democratic challengers, and with President-elect Joe Biden on the verge of becoming the first Democratic presidential candidate to win Georgia since 1992. The Republican Secretary of State, Raffensperger, dismissed part of Loeffler and Perdue's claims as, quote, laughable. As the number of U.S. COVID-19 cases tops 10 million, President-elect Joe Biden gave a nationally televised address Monday warning of a dark winter ahead, pleading for the use of face masks.
I implore you, wear a mask. Do it for yourself. Do it for your neighbor. A mask is not a political statement, but it is a good way to start pulling the country together. I want to be very clear. The goal of mask wearing is not to make your life less comfortable. It's to take something or take something away from you. It's to give something back to all of us, a normal life.
This comes as two more close associates of President Trump have tested positive for the virus. Housing Secretary Dr. Ben Carson and the attorney David Bossie, who's leading Trump's post-election legal challenges. Meanwhile, global stocks soared on Monday following news from Pfizer that early data from a large clinical trial shows its coronavirus vaccine cuts symptomatic COVID-19 cases by more than 90%. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Laurie Garrett after headlines. In news from the Middle East, Saeb Erekat, the Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization, has died at 65 after he became infected with COVID-19. Erekat was a key Palestinian negotiator involved in peace talks for over three decades. He famously showed up at the 1991 Madrid conference proudly wearing a keffiyeh, a symbol of Palestinian nationalism. He stood in staunch opposition to Trump's Middle East plan, which he called the fraud of the century, and condemned recent agreements normalizing relations between Israel and Gulf nations. This is Saeb Erekat speaking in 2018.
I think as Palestinians, we have defined our interest as no one benefits more from achieving peace than us, and nobody stands to lose more in the absence of peace more than us.
Erekat is survived by his wife, four children, and eight grandchildren. Back in Washington, D.C., President Trump has fired Defense Secretary Mark Esper. This comes months after Esper clashed with Trump by opposing the deployment of active-duty troops to respond to the nationwide protests sparked by the police killing of George Floyd. On Monday, Trump announced Christopher Miller, the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, would serve as acting defense secretary. Senator Ron Wyden responded on Twitter by writing, quote, Donald Trump fired someone who would not order U.S. troops to attack peaceful protesters and is replacing him with someone he may think will carry out those orders, unquote. During an interview last week with Military Times, Esper suggested he would soon be fired because he stood up to Trump. He said, quote, who's going to come in behind me? It's going to be a real yes man, and then God help us, he said. The Supreme Court's hearing arguments today in a case seeking to overturn the Affordable Care Act. The Republican effort could strip away the health care of over 20 million people and deny protections for pre-existing conditions as well as preventive care amidst a devastating pandemic that has caused millions to lose their employer-based health insurance. The court now has a 6-3 conservative majority. During last month's Senate confirmation hearing, Justice Amy Coney Barrett refused to recuse herself from the cases on the Affordable Care Act, even though she's been critical of Obama's signature legislation in the past. President-elect Joe Biden's delivering a speech today defending the ACA, which he vowed to expand during his campaign, though progressive Democrats and public opinion favors a universal health care system or Medicare for all. In Bolivia, former President Evo Morales has returned to his country after 1 year in exile following a right-wing military coup that overthrew Morales last November. Thousands of supporters celebrated Morales' triumphant return as he crossed into Bolivia by foot through the border with Argentina, where he'd been living since last year. This is Morales speaking to his throngs of supporters yesterday.
La lucha sigue.
The fight continues. While imperialism and capitalism exists, the struggle of the people will continue. I am convinced of that, brothers and sisters.
Evo Morales' return follows the swearing-in of Luis Arce as the new Bolivian president and the return of Morales' MAS party to power. Peru has been thrown into political uncertainty after lawmakers ousted President Martin Vizcarra on Monday in his impeachment trial. The vote to remove him on charges of corruption came 2 months after a failed impeachment in September on an unrelated accusation of obstruction of justice. Some lawmakers and protesters decried the vote as a political ploy ahead of elections in 2021 and said the political chaos could further hamper the response to the coronavirus pandemic, which has devastated Peru. In Armenia, protesters stormed a government building in the capital Yerevan on Monday night following the announcement of an agreement to end the raging six-week conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh. Protesters say the deal, which was signed by the president, does not represent the will of the Armenian people, and the Armenian prime minister said military actions in the region are not over yet. The deal came after Azerbaijan seized control of the second-largest city in Nagorno-Karabakh and after Azeri forces admitted to shooting down a Russian helicopter, which they claimed was an accident. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Tuesday Russian peacekeepers will be deployed along the front line. It's estimated the conflict has killed at least 1,000 people and displaced over 100,000, though some say the death toll is much higher. In Georgia, protests continued Monday, one day after police fired water cannons on crowds in the capital, Tbilisi, as they called for a rerun of recent parliamentary elections they and the country's main opposition parties say were rigged. The elections saw the ruling Georgian Dream Party, which was founded by Georgia's wealthiest man, declaring victory. Meanwhile, protests continue in Belarus, where hundreds were again arrested over the weekend as people call for President Alexander Lukashenko to resign following August elections they say were rigged. At least 9 journalists were believed to be among those arrested on Sunday. On Friday, the European Union imposed sanctions on Lukashenko for his violent crackdown on protests. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif called on regional powers to engage in peaceful talks following reports Trump's planning to slap a series of new sanctions on Iran in the coming weeks in coordination with Israel and several Gulf states. Foreign Minister Zarif tweeted, quote, "A sincere message to our neighbors. Trump's gone in 70 days, but we'll remain here forever. Betting on outsiders to provide security is never a good gamble. We extend our hand to our neighbors for dialogue to resolve differences. Only together can we build a better future for all," he said. Axios, which reported the possible sanctions, said the Trump administration hopes the move will make it harder for Joe Biden's administration to revive the 2015 nuclear deal, which Trump unilaterally withdrew from. In Cancun, Mexico, at least 2 local reporters were wounded after police opened fire against a crowd of people protesting femicides and violence against women. Protests erupted across the state of Quintana Roo on Monday after the body of 20-year-old Bianca Alejandrina Lorenzana, known as Alexis, was found earlier in the day. She'd been missing all weekend after leaving her home for work. At least a dozen other femicides have been reported in the state of Quintana Roo this year. On average, 10 women are murdered in Mexico every day, according to Mexican officials. In immigration news, The Guardian reports nearly 50 Cameroonian asylum seekers are scheduled to be deported today. Some of them are activists who face arrest warrants in Cameroon and political persecution from government forces known for conducting extrajudicial killings. Several have told The Guardian ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, have tortured them into signing their deportation papers and forcibly took their fingerprints. Last month, dozens of Cameroonian asylum seekers were deported. Many of them are now missing. Advocates say Black asylum seekers are being disproportionately targeted with mass deportations by the Trump administration. In other immigration news, lawyers working on reuniting children who are separated from their families at the southern border say they still cannot find the parents of 666 children, over 100 more children than previously reported. The children were taken away from their families between April and June 2018 at the height of Trump's zero-tolerance family separation policy. And a federal court has temporarily blocked the construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline pending an ongoing appeal from environmental groups. The 300-mile pipeline would cross through wetlands and streams in Virginia and West Virginia. Activists have long argued a permit allowing its construction violates environmental laws and could pose catastrophic threats to vital waterways. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York.
To let you go. But your mouth tells me to stay with you, and I'll never seem to understand the way you need me to hold your hand, to hold your hand.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. Wednesday, there will be a light rain and a high of 21 degrees Celsius. Thursday will be a mix of sun and clouds and a high of 10 degrees Celsius. Friday will be mainly sunny at 8 degrees Celsius. Saturday will be mainly sunny with a high of 5 degrees. Sunday, there will be a chance of a shower and 6 degrees Celsius. Monday will be cloudy with showers at 9 degrees Celsius. Tuesday will be cloudy with showers at 5 degrees Celsius. Well, that wraps up the Wednesday morning after for another week. Stay safe, stay well. There's more ahead on CKUT.
I want to make you happy, but everything else seems better than me, and we're high.
Solidarity News on Radio Labour. This is a Radio Labor Canada report recorded on Friday, November 6, 2020. I'm Marc Boulanger. In the report this week, Ontario's anti-worker budget, organizing during a pandemic, the Labor Start report about union events and singing. This is Radio Labor. The Ontario government has released a new budget to guide its expenditures in the months ahead. Unions are saying the budget does not meet the needs of workers who are facing a pandemic and job loss. I talked to Fred Hahn about the budget. Mr. Hahn is the president of QP Ontario. I asked him about his views on the budget released by the Doug Ford Conservative government.
We're very concerned because, to be quite honest, the Ford Conservatives have been quite successful in convincing people in Ontario that they're spending money to keep us safe, that they're doing everything they can to deal with COVID-19. But what some people might not have seen is that the Financial Accountability Officer of the Province of Ontario, an independent officer who is charged with reviewing government spending, has issued two reports, the most recent one saying that, in fact, the government of Ontario is sitting on over $9 billion that they allocated for COVID-19 spending that they have not yet spent, $9 billion. It also notes that of the spending that the Ontario government has done during COVID-19, since the beginning of the pandemic, 97% of all of the money expended by the Ontario government has actually been federal money, transfers from the federal government that flowed through the province of Ontario. These are alarming statistics for those of us who are seeing the devastation of the second wave, quite honestly. There was just a report that in Ontario, there are 581 schools that have confirmed cases of coronavirus. We heard a lot from education workers and from parents about their worries about keeping kids and workers safe, about the concerns that they weren't properly funding schools to reopen safely, to allow for social distancing and other measures. They had money they were sitting on that they refused to spend, and here we are in November, and 581 schools in our province have outbreaks, and they're sitting on $9 billion. Sorry, I get a little upset about it, as you could probably hear from my voice.
Is there anything specific in the budget that you object to?
Well, one of the things that is starkly missing here is the need to raise revenue in the province of Ontario. Now, this is something that our union and others have talked about with Ontario governments for some years, because before the Conservatives, the Liberals actually lowered corporate taxes and taxes on the richest Ontarians systematically year over year over year. What that did was lower the revenue of government, lower the collective resources available to fund public services to deal with pandemics and emergencies like the one that we are in. But it has become clear to so many that as a result of the pandemic, you know, there's a saying that we're all in the same boat with COVID-19. And I actually heard a very wise woman say that, well, we're not actually in the same boat. We may be all on the same river, but some of us are in yachts and some of us are on rafts that are being barely held together. There are profitable corporations who are making even larger profits as a result of the pandemic. The super rich in our province are benefiting from the pandemic. Now is the time to say that we must raise taxes on corporations and the wealthiest in our province to generate more revenue into collective coffers to not only deal with this tragedy, but to fund services in the future to strengthen our capacity to deal with these kinds of things in the future. That is missing from the Ontario budget. It is a massive gaping hole. Because here's what we're going to hear. Here's our concern. One day there will be a day of reckoning. And the four conservatives will come to all of us and say, look at this giant deficit we have. We have run up this huge deficit. Now, we had to do it. I mean, it was COVID-19. But now we're going to have to cut services. It's the only option. And it is not the only option. In fact, the best and only option they should be exploring is raising taxes on profitable corporations and the wealthiest in our province.
How do you organize workers during a pandemic? That was the question addressed by union organizers in a recent webinar conducted by Education International. EI is the global union for teachers and other education workers. One of the resource people in the webinar was Jane McAlvey, a union organizer in the United States. She started her presentation showing a number of slides.
What I showed was a picture of 34,000 teachers walking out, and a beautiful picture of 34,000 teachers in Los Angeles walking out. And to get there, they had to practice a mechanism called structure tests. And the structure is the school site. And so what's different between organizing and mobilizing is that in mobilizing, which is what most teachers' unions and most unions are doing, whether it's in Europe or around the world, or definitely in the United States, what it mostly means we're doing is we're talking to the teachers who want to talk to us. We're only making an effort. We call a meeting. If we're doing a good job, we call a meeting, and people show up at a meeting. And it's never a very high percentage of the members who show up at a meeting, because who wants to go to an extra meeting? We generally run not very good meetings, and then we rely on who shows up, and we blame the people who don't show up, right? We literally say, well, we called a meeting, and if those teachers didn't show up to the meeting, too bad. That's actually the opposite of organizing. Organizing means we wake up in the morning, and we have a plan, literally, to engage every single teacher into every single school every single week. And it means we're spending most of our time talking to the teachers who do not come to our meetings, are not in our social media feeds, and do not think they want to talk to us. That's the difference between a mobilizing approach or an advocacy approach, either one of them, and what we call a deep organizing approach. In the United States, the biggest strikes, which have led to the biggest improvements in standards for students and learning and teacher outcomes, has been the unions that are practicing the organizing approach, by which they make a plan every single week about how to engage every single teacher in every single school. That's what organizing is. And it's very different than the approach that most teacher unions rely on, which is, let's talk to whoever shows up.
Another participant in the EI webinar about organizing in the education sector was John Hegarty, an organizer for the National Education Union, the NEU, in the United Kingdom.
Where we are in terms of organizing is we're 10 years into a project. This stuff doesn't happen overnight. You know, our organizing strategy as the National Union has gone on for a long time. And it's involved building rep structures, building training, recruiting activists over years. But in terms of what we did during COVID, there were some digital tools that we used. We used a lot of Zoom meetings. At one point, we had 20,000 members on a Zoom call. We used Call Hub as a technology, with one of our aims was to phone every single one of our workplace reps. So that's 10,000 reps. We got through to nearly 4,000 and spoke to them. And one of the things that we were asking our reps to do was to meet with members, gather a petition as to people's opposition to wider reopening, and take that to the school management, which was a structure test. Because one of the things that was happening was reps were then coming back to us and saying, not everybody wants to sign it. What do I do? And we were then using those models that James talked about. We were saying, OK, you're going to have to talk to the people who aren't on our side. This is how we do it. This is a structured organising conversation. What you're doing is a structure test. You're going to build power. And the result of that work over the last few months of the crisis is we've recruited 50,000 new members. We've recruited 3,500 new workplace reps. We've trained over 3,500 activists. And the union, when it came to the government's demand for wider reopening, we managed to stop 70% of schools opening more widely.
Here with his report is Labor Start correspondent Derek Blackadder.
Big stories on our Canadian news pages since my last report include the announcement that the FTQ is organizing an all-Quebec demonstration of support for the province's essential public sector workers. For 15 minutes on November the 12th, people will be asked to stop work and demonstrate their solidarity. And as the Newfoundland and Labrador strike against Dominion Stores and its parent corporation Loblaws continued into its third month this week, Unifor ramped up the pressure with secondary pickets not only in Newfoundland and Labrador, but across the country. Keep a lookout for calls for solidarity picketing in your area and do what you can to support people that Loblaws called essential just a few months ago as those workers fight to get back their $2 an hour pandemic pay. Almost at the other end of the country, UFCW members are also gearing up for a fight as they call for the return of pandemic pay for both retail workers and for meat packers. And given the high infection and death rate amongst meat packers and family members, UFCW is also pushing hard for pandemic safety. No surprise, but on the COVID-19 beat, our volunteers continue to collect a large number of stories. The big one from Canada this week was the Chief Public Health Officer's report linking C-19 incidents and mortality rates to social and economic inequality. Canadian labor history items on our site for this week included the formation in 1908 of the Newfoundland and Labrador Fishermen's Protective Union. The FPU went on to build and run Port Union, North America's only union-built town. Canadian stories on our Working Women page included a report detailing how New Brunswick's community care system depends on undervaluing and underpaying women workers. And though not formally a news story of any kind, let alone one about women workers, the list of healthcare workers killed by C-19 that appears on the Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions website tells a sad tale. The vast majority of workers listed are, of course, women. Ken Kahn on our Global Health and Safety Newswire includes coverage of the high suicide rate amongst workers in the visual effects industry, where the demands of film and TV production place incredible stress on employees and where workplace abuse is rampant. And we also had a number of stories about the challenges workers and unions face as those who can continue to work at home. Current campaigns that we are running at the request of unions around the world include an urgent appeal for online solidarity with the Colombian Education Union activists who have received death threats from far-right paramilitaries, this in a country where trade unionists routinely risk their lives in doing the work that we do every day without even thinking about it. Look for details of this and other campaigns on our site.
Now here is Union Nation with How Can We Let This Go On?
Everybody's talking about the changes in the pension, and you really can't ignore it. It's really worth a mention. It starts at the top with a $5 million bonus, and it's really gotta stop. You gotta put the onus on the people with the vision, the people with decision. How can we work together when it's causing such division? How can we let this go on, y'all? How can we let this go on? Just because a man sits in a big oval office doesn't give the man the right to steal from the coffers. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and the man in the middle, well, he's just a working whore. How can we let this go on? Huh. How can we let this go on?
And that's it, labor news you can use. You can find our international features and daily newscasts on our website at radiolabor.net. Follow us on Twitter at Radio Labor. I'm Mark Boulanger. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about solidarity.
Scratching it too hard.
I got headaches from screaming too loud. I got so much on my mind, I cannot think straight. Oh, I cannot think straight, no. But oh, with you, everything falls into place. Try to put my foot down. Oh, but you take away all the weight. Oh, oh, you take away the weight. Oh, with you, everything falls into place.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello, and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are facing many different struggles talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I'll be speaking with Shannon Hardy and Bridget Graham. While abortion has been decriminalized in Canada since 1988, that does not mean that accessing abortion services is necessarily an easy or smooth process for everyone who needs them. For some of the cisgender women, trans men, and other gender diverse people who do so, it can be difficult to find information about how abortion services work and where and how to access them. In some parts of the country, there are few or even no providers of abortion services, so some people have to travel long distances. The expense and logistical challenges involved, in some instances in combination with out-of-pocket fees for the services, can be a barrier for low-income people and people marginalized in other ways. And abortion still carries significant stigma, which can make it harder for people to access the kinds of formal and informal supports that they might otherwise draw on to overcome barriers. Back in 2012, Shannon Hardy was a birth doula, that is, someone who provides guidance and support during labor, and she was working as the education coordinator at an education-oriented sex shop and bookstore in Halifax. She got an email about a rally related to abortion. Specifically, the rally was because there was not a single provider of abortion services in all of Prince Edward Island. Hardy had no idea that there was a Canadian province or territory that just did not offer this basic element of healthcare, and it made her mad. And that very day, she started rallying friends, comrades, and colleagues to start doing something about it. The original mission was to support people from PEI in getting to abortion appointments in Halifax through offering rides and helping with accommodations. And from there, it all just sort of grew. They got more and more requests for support from an ever-broadening range of people and developed a growing network of volunteers to meet those requests. They started doing some fundraising. Hardy developed a training that she's given in many different places to those who want to support people having abortions, and attending a training was how Bridget Graham, who's also a doula, first got involved. For a while, the scope of the network was just the Maritimes, but they developed a presence in Newfoundland and Labrador in 2017 and took on the name Abortion Support Services Atlantic. From being a response to one specific need, the organization ended up becoming, as its Facebook page says, quote, a 100% volunteer-run pro-reproductive rights group providing support for anyone having an abortion in the Atlantic provinces, end quote. For a number of years, Hardy did the bulk of the work guiding and coordinating the group, but about 2 years ago, they put together a board of directors with members from across Atlantic Canada. Currently, Hardy is the group's coordinator, and Graham is its director of volunteers. The kinds of support they offer have remained quite similar. Often people who contact them are looking for information related to abortion services, so the group's work can be as simple as providing it. It's also not unusual for them to get messages from people far beyond Atlantic Canada, and over the years they've developed a network of contacts that can offer information and support relevant to places around the world. Much of what they do, however, continues to involve rides, accommodations, and other forms of practical support for people accessing abortion services in Atlantic Canada. Though it's a bit less direct, Graham and Hardy say that resisting stigma is also an important element of the organization's work. The word abortion is prominently present in the group's name, and in its communications and in the activities of its lead activists, they're very upfront about what the group is about. They believe that even just using the word unapologetically and broadcasting far and wide that they offer matter-of-fact, compassionate support helps some people push back against the insidious power of stigma and shame. Hardy says, quote, just the fact that we exist, I think, is a form of harm reduction, end quote. I speak with Hardy and Graham about the barriers to accessing abortion services in Atlantic Canada and about the grassroots response that is Abortion Support Services Atlantic.
I'm Shannon Hardy. I'm the founder and coordinator of Abortion Support Services Atlantic. I'm a registered social worker in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I was raised mainly by women. My aunties and my mom would sit around the table drinking copious amounts of tea, solving the world's problems. Much of my family is Indigenous. I'm not, but my extended family is. And so I was raised with, you know, the idea of community care and helping out each other just was very ingrained in me from a young age. My family are pretty hardcore socialists, and we just believe in helping people when you can help people. Abortion Support Services Atlantic has volunteers across all four Atlantic provinces that can help people access abortion care, whether that means they need a ride to their appointment or they need information about how to access care, they need funding perhaps, or information. We can provide all of that for them.
And I'm Bridget Graham. I'm a doula, and I'm based in Halifax as well, and I'm the Director of Volunteers for Abortion Support Services Atlantic. I grew up in a really small community in Ontario. Agriculture was the driving factor in the community, and my parents always really encouraged me to volunteer a lot and to give back to the community since they had really supported me at a young age. So in high school, and I would say in the first few years that I moved to Halifax and university, a lot of the community work that I was doing was in the environmental sector, especially in regards to getting youth interested and passionate about the environment. But when I was writing my master's, I just felt like my activism wasn't really making a difference. It was just too hard. It was too big for me to see the impact that I was having. And I decided to become a doula. I did my training. I started in 2017, and that's when I met Shannon and took the training for ASA. And I really just started to see that if I was living in Nova Scotia, this was something that I could do to make an impact in the community.
Give listeners a bit of an overview of how abortion care works in Atlantic Canada. And I know it's different in each province, so don't worry about all the details. Just give us a sense.
So to distill it down, in Nova Scotia, all abortions are performed at hospital, generally in Halifax. To access support here, you don't actually have to go through your doctor. We have a self-referral line, which has made a huge impact on people's ability to be able to access. So anyone in Nova Scotia can call the self-referral line. They'll speak to a nurse who will help them set up ultrasound and blood work and make their appointment for them. And that's what they need to do to get the ball rolling. Generally in Newfoundland, Labrador, there's one clinic. Abortions generally happen at that one clinic in St. John, the Athena Clinic, and then New Brunswick and PEI, again, have different options.
What are the origins of Abortion Support Services Atlantic?
I had been a birth doula for about 6 years before this started. I was really involved in the doula community and the birthing community. I was co-founder of the Nova Scotia Doula Association, so invested in both the community but also building of that. And I was working at Venus Envy, which is a sex shop and bookstore here in Halifax, as the education coordinator. So a lot of things would pass over my desk. And then one day in 2012, I got this email that something about PEI. They were having an abortion rally because there was no abortion on the island and they were trying to get that changed. And I didn't know that. You know, I had lived in Halifax for a few years from then, but I'm originally from Vancouver and I had no idea that we had a province or territory that just did not offer abortion. And it just blew my mind. I was angry and I didn't know how that was okay. So literally that day I started a Facebook page and called up all of my doula friends, all of my queer friends, all of my radical friends, and the groups often overlap, and just said, we're doing something. We will pick people up on the island and we will drive them back to Halifax to get their appointments. We're doing something. This just is not okay. And that's how it started.
What was involved in figuring out the logistics of going from that initial call out to figuring out how practically it was going to work?
I wish I had a better answer than we just did it. Literally, we just did it. I think if there had been thought involved, we might have got scared and realized what we were doing was ridiculous. But we just connected with the reproductive rights group in PEI and said, we want to offer this. And because I had co-founded the Nova Scotia Doula Association, I was known in the doula community. I worked at Venus Envy, and so I was a well-known educator. I wasn't just a completely random person. I did have a background. So I reached out to people and they would just message us and either I would go or I would call up somebody and say, do you have time to drive to the bridge? Because that's generally what we do. Drive to Confederation Bridge. Somebody from the PEI Reproductive Rights Organization would drive the person to meet us at the bridge and then we would drive into Halifax. And we just sort of learned what worked and what didn't. You know, at the beginning, we offered lodging at people's houses and that didn't work. So we ended up fundraising for money for hotel rooms. Yeah. So there really were tons of conversations. It was just, this needs to be done. And so we're doing it today.
And the only reason I laugh is because that's how I know of the origin story of this. And I can't imagine it any other way. Like Shannon and this group of people just decided, we want to help people. We need to help people. This is what we're going to do. And it's been so powerful. And I say that we're more organized now a little bit, but it's still like if a request comes in, we just kind of mobilize and we make it happen.
How did that process of growth happen for the organization? Going from just responding to that one need experienced by people from PEI to covering all of the Atlantic provinces?
When we first started, we were Maritime Abortion Support Services, and we exclusively just helped people from PEI to come into Halifax.
the group of volunteers was smaller. We didn't really do any fundraising. Like, it was just really small. And then as people started knowing who we were and that we weren't sketchy or anything like that, we started building a relationship with our termination of pregnancy unit at the hospital. So they knew who we were and who our volunteers were. All of that started happening. We started getting more requests, and I was doing everything. I was coordinating volunteers. I was doing media requests. You know, it was a lot. And I was resistant to having people come in to help because I had a very clear vision of what I wanted things to be. And I didn't want to give up my creation. But 2 years ago, this January, so 2018, I just couldn't do it by myself anymore. And that's when I reached out for board members. And thank goodness I am surrounded by really awesome people who just take the load off. It's been amazing. And in 2017, I did a training in Corner Brook, Newfoundland. And that's when we changed the name to Atlantic Abortion Support Services. And we have a trained volunteer in Labrador.
Shannon is the chair, and we have Megan, a co-chair. And then we have representatives from different regions. So the folks on the board, we have somebody from New Brunswick, a couple of folks from Newfoundland and Labrador, and then folks from Nova Scotia as well. It's really great that we are so spread out and that we can help so many people in so many different parts of the country.
As co-founder of the Nova Scotia Doula Association, something that happened very quickly is it became the Halifax Doula Association. And that always bothered me and was something that I wish I could rectify. So when I called myself Maritime Abortion Support, and then we changed to Abortion Support Services Atlantic, I wanted to honor that. If we say we have Atlantic in our name, we are going to have representatives in every Atlantic province, because we can't distill services to just one area or one urban area. There needs to be people across the provinces that can help. So that was really important to me.
How did you originally connect with the project, Bridget?
So I took the training that Shannon offers, the abortion doula training, in the summer of 2017, and just decided that this was something I wanted to do. I wanted to help in any way possible. There was a call out for board members, and I applied to coordinate volunteering, so to mobilize people. And I would say it was something that the first few months I was incredibly nervous, just to say the wrong thing or not to respond quickly enough, or just it was a lot of unknowns. But again, Shannon would just walk me through it, and we would respond to the requests, and we would find people, and we would make it happen. And now it's kind of second nature. A request comes in, and we have so many people who are willing to help, either with their time, driving people, or financially, that like it's just really incredible to see how the organization is growing. And yeah, some days I just wake up and I pick somebody up and drive them to their appointment. And like, I love connecting with people and supporting them, but it's also like such a small action on my part, but it makes such a huge impact. People are always so grateful. I just really love the conversations that we have and being able to just talk to people in the community, people that I know that I do this work, and I try and bring it up as much as I can. I'm a doula, but I always start by saying I'm an abortion doula, as well as labor and birth and postpartum. But the abortion work, that's what I do the most of, and it's what means the most to me.
We've already touched on some aspects of this, particularly the absolute lack of services in some areas. But more generally, what would you say are the key barriers that people in Atlantic Canada face in accessing abortion services?
One big thing is a lot of folks don't have rides. I would say that's the majority of what we help with. Well, first, it's lack of information. It's hard to navigate. Maybe people don't have reliable internet access or telephone access. So first off, it's helping them find the self-referral line and saying that like we can't set up their appointment, but we can put them in contact with people who can help them with that. So that's the first thing. And then I would say a lot of times it's helping people get to and from their appointments. So dropping them off and picking them up. People can't leave the hospital on their own. There has to be someone there to support them, to take them home. So that's what we encounter most frequently, is either the person's on their own, they don't have somebody to support them, or maybe they do have someone to support them, but they don't have a car. So that's a huge barrier. And so that's pretty simple for us, right? We get the request, we kind of figure out when their appointment is, and then we'll put a call out to the volunteers and say, hey, we need somebody to be dropped off at their appointment at 7 a.m. Can somebody do that? And can someone pick them up afterwards? That's a huge one. And then I would say if people are coming from different parts of the provinces or from the province, especially for Halifax, it's like, okay, if they're coming in the day before for an appointment that's at 7 a.m., where are they going to stay? Sometimes people know people and they can stay at their house, but if not, they don't. So we can set them up. We have a few spots in the city where we can help make sure that they have somewhere to stay overnight before their appointment. So I would say that those two are big barriers, or perhaps somebody has a car, but they just don't have enough money, or the person supporting them, they don't have the funds to be able to get to the city. So we also provide like gas money for people. So I would say like transportation and then lodging would be two big ones.
This doesn't happen as often as rides, but we also help people navigate if they have to leave the Atlantic provinces to have their abortion, because, you know, you have gestational limits. So if people need help navigating the funding for that or support in the city that they have to go to, we also do that. So lots of logistics. And I just want to say, we also have a really great network of people across the globe. When somebody sends us a Facebook message from South Africa, we have somebody we can send you to. If somebody from Kansas sends us a message, we have a doula for you. In the last 8.5 years that we've existed, we have created a really spectacular network of supports across the globe. And it's one of my favorite things that we've done.
What's your sense of who's active as volunteers with the group and who's accessing it for support?
I'm always super amazed at, like, there's people from all over, people from every background, different ages. We have, like, I would say multi-generational sets of volunteers. And the people who take the training then go and talk to their friends and family about it, right? So I know from personal experience, my mother-in-law decided she wanted to volunteer. She wanted to get involved, and she could do that, right? Like, we said, okay, fill out our intake form and we'll put you on the list and we will reach out to you. So it's really whoever wants to volunteer. We ask them some questions, but we're pretty open and just happy to have people. So I would say that's been really incredible. And then the people who access our services, it's kind of the same thing. It's people from all over, people from all sorts of backgrounds, people who don't have children, people who have had children. Really, it's anybody who needs it, or maybe it's somebody who's asking for information on behalf of a partner or a friend. Something that I also try and do is I've done a couple of lectures at local universities just talking about what this sort of work looks like and how we support people. And it's been really eye-opening to see people in the lectures share their own experience with access as well. So I always start by putting the number up for the self-referral line and saying, does anybody know what this number is? And asking people, write this down, share this number with your friends and family.
And I think, at least this has been the feedback I've gotten from people we support, just by being there, having the word abortion in our title helps people feel less stigmatized, feel like if there's this group out there who is willing to support me, then maybe I can talk to my family, or maybe I don't have to feel so much internalized shame about what's going on. Just the fact that we exist, I think, is a form of harm reduction.
One challenge that some grassroots mutual aid projects like this one can face is, how do you let people know that you exist? What approaches have you taken to doing that? And where do you think more work in that area remains to be done?
We're pretty busy. So
yeah.
So I don't know that we want to advertise anymore, but I guess it also comes back to having abortion in the title of our group. We have never tried to hide or be sneaky about what we do. Maybe this was that lack of thought process at the very beginning, but I was like, nope, abortion is in the title. Because if abortion isn't in the title, then people won't know what we do. And I think, I hope that that's why people find us when they Google us. It's like abortion in Halifax. Our organization is going to pop up. Being very vocal. So on social media, we have a director of communication, Emma Duke. She's up in St. John, and she is a regular poster on Facebook and Twitter. We're very vocal about what we do. We have a great relationship here in Halifax with our termination pregnancy unit. So they've given people our name. And yeah, like Bridget just said, we talk about it all the time.
any chance that I can use the term abortion, like in any bio that I write, it's there. The whole name is there so that people can find us. And like on social media, Shannon also leads training, not just in Halifax. And because of COVID, those have moved online. So it actually becomes kind of more accessible to people. But then every person who takes the training, then they can mobilize their whole network. But I would say, yeah, we're busy. Like, we got a lot going on. And that's a great thing.
Good point about the training. Because I do trainings across Canada, there is now Abortion Support Collective in Ottawa, in northern Manitoba, in Thompson, in Saskatchewan. There's one in Alberta, but Autumn had that before me. BC is working on creating the new collective. So we sparked something. Like, it's just spectacular that it just caught on. And once you say the word, and you're like, I'm offering abortion training. That's what I need. The trainings are always full.
When your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Thank you.
Need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Red alert. The spread of COVID-19 is at a critical level in your area or a neighboring region. Getting together with family or friends is prohibited, and traveling to other regions is not recommended. More targeted restrictions have been put into place to limit the spread and prevent a lockdown. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Continue to wash your hands, keep a 2-meter distance, and wear a mask when physical distancing is impossible. We need to act now. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
So, other than that, I mean, you know, what's going on? What do you say?
Buenas tardes.
And we'll be back.
Missed your favorite show? Not a problem. Go to www.ckut.ca and follow the link to CKUT's easy-to-use archives. Instructions are on the page. 2 months' worth of archives are stored in mono and half a month's worth in stereo.
Pleasant good afternoon to you, Montreal.
If you're having trouble, please email sys@ckut.ca. That's sys@ckut.ca.